From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. With all this concern about hacking into election systems, how's Michigan doing?
So we got a C, which is a solid middle-of-the-road grade.
And we'll talk about a ballot initiative that wants to remove barriers to registering to vote and voting how the people want.
50% of the people in the last two presidential elections actually used straight party tickets.
Then the governor announced a Marshall Plan for talent, getting more people trained in skilled trades and professions.
How do you do a Marshall Plan for talent if we're declining in third grade reading scores?
Good question. Then an interview on Stateside about Michigan breweries inspires a drink.
It was a fascinating piece, and it really got me thinking about beer cocktails.
Hate when that happens. All those stories and more coming up. Hi there, welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Getting kids to school in Detroit can be a real hassle. I've talked to parents who drive their kids nearly 30 minutes to get them to their school of choice, whether that's a public school or a charter school. In his State of the City address this week, Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan outlined a plan. Pick an area, then offer bus service from school to school, public or private, and to a center for daycare.
Let's take an area in northwest Detroit, say Southfield, Livernois, and Fenkel to 8 Mile. And we've got about a dozen charter and DPS schools. Let's have a combined bus route that serves both of them.
So keep the buses running in a loop from school to school. A student can catch the bus at the nearest school to his or her house and then be delivered to the school they actually attend. Duggan says the city, the Detroit Public Schools Community District, charter schools, as well as philanthropic organizations will have to work on a pilot program just to see how this goes. Well, Tanya Allen is the president and CEO of the Skillman Foundation, and they are on board for this project. What was it about this bus loop project that made sense to you?
Well, thank you for having me, Lester. And one of the things that made sense for us is that we have heard from families for many years that they need transportation to get their children to school. One of the biggest concerns we see from families and one of the biggest determinants in parents choosing school is whether or not they feel like their children are safe. And so this is a successful model that occurred in Denver that's being brought to Detroit that would get families to and from one of 10 schools, all which are stronger schools in our city, as well as get to transport them to after-school programming, which we believe is important for all children.
Yeah, as the mayor described, this is in northwest part of the city, and there are stops. Actually, how this would happen is buses would start doing that loop, and they would stop at each of the schools. And then the Northwest Activity Center would also be a stop. I was just at that center recently. It's very nice. Duggan wants a daycare program established there. That way kids could catch the bus at school and ride to the activity center, do homework or a program there, then catch the bus to the school nearest their home. And the buses would keep running until 6:30 at night. So how critical is having that community center to this whole plan?
Oh, it's absolutely critical. It is, it becomes a hub of the community and making sure that kids can get to it. We, as a foundation, ran a loop very similar to this that just went to after school programs, in Southwest Detroit, and families absolutely love this. They need this kind of service. And I think the one thing that the mayor has done that's been pretty amazing is to organize it where this pilot will actually be able to be in place for 5 years to make sure that all families, if they sign up for it, that they know it's going to be there for the long run. And then the second thing related to it that I think it's important, it is going to be a financially sustainable model. So yes, there are philanthropy, which is us and the city that's coming in, and the public school systems that are coming in. So I think once we prove the value of this model and the practicality of the model, it'll give us an opportunity to expand it so that we offer families more opportunities.
Well, self-sustaining, you said, generally speaking, foundations like yours want to see projects become self-sustaining. How can that happen in this situation? How is it going to pay for itself?
One of the things that we believe in this model is that if this model is successful at recruiting families who have who live in Detroit but choose to send their kids outside of Detroit because they now have access to high-quality schools, they now have access to safety and transportation and after-school programming, that those new revenue dollars that come into either charters or public school systems will be able to help subsidize these costs. So we know that many schools are doing this, and the mayor articulated it in his State of the City address, where he showed the bus route for River Rouge schools, which is figuring out a way to carve out money from their resources to run a bus route around the entire city of Detroit.
Yeah, the mayor said River Rouge has 200 miles of bus route, and they take Detroit cities back to their school district and get that school aid money.
That's exactly right, and they're not the only ones. Oak Park, more than 50% of the kids who attend Oak Park schools live in the city of Detroit. I'm not critiquing Oak Park or River Rouge. What I am suggesting is that this bus route is a way for Detroit to have a ground game that's focused on increasing our market share of students rather than what has been happening in our city for a really long time, which is Detroit Public Schools Community District and the charters fighting over a shrinking market share of students. What we're saying is stop fighting over those students. Let's serve those students well, and then let's also go after some of the 27,000 kids who leave our city every single day to go to school in another community.
I'm wondering what kind of effect do you think this will have on people who actually live in that area right now, but they send their kids to a school across town?
Well, I think that it will expand their opportunities. And what we're hoping is that they'll have confidence that the city and the people who run the city and who care deeply about this city care deeply about them, that they know that we're trying to make Detroit a great place for them to raise their children, and that any parent or grandparent would be able to see that and detect it because of the services and the innovations that we're putting in place.
So when does this service start?
The service is going to start at the top of the new school year in 2018-19. So in September, this bus route will be going, but we will be out in the field in the next couple of months talking deeply with parents to understand what their concerns are, what their desires are, because what we want this system to do is be customer-driven, user-driven. So we want to make sure that we're meeting their needs, not just providing a service that we think is useful.
Tanya Allen is the president and CEO of the Skillman Foundation. We've been talking about a project that would offer a looping bus service to 11 schools, both public and private, and a community center in Northwest Detroit. Thanks for explaining the project to us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings, and we're here for another cocktail during the Cheers segment. What do you have for us this time?
Today I have something called the Old Trousers. I was listening to your great piece from a couple weeks ago about Brewed in Michigan.
Oh, book. With William Rapai. Yeah,
that's
the book.
Right.
Yeah.
It was a fascinating piece, and it really got me thinking about beer cocktails.
Ah, great. Well, what kind of beer are we going to have in this cocktail?
Well, so we're having my favorite Michigan beer, or, well, I should say one of my favorite Michigan beers, which is the Founders Porter. Sort of my go-to winter beer. I like a nice hoppy IPA in the summer, but this is what I turn to in the winter time.
Understandable. I'll get that. I've had that before. It's nice.
And then we're pairing that up with a rum, but it's a rum that came to us sort of by virtue of beer, because this is the New Holland Freshwater Michigan rum. And New Holland started in 1997 as a brewery, and then in 2005 they started distilling as well. And so now they have a big line of different products.
I didn't know they even made rum.
Yep, they do make rum. It's a molasses-based rum, and I was amazed when I tasted it. It's only 6 months old, and I wanted to see, you know, how they accomplished that. And so it looks like they age it in a variety of barrels. So they're aging it in new oak barrels, used barrels that probably have had whiskey in them before, and then they're also aging them in used wine barrels.
So, oh, right. I've heard about that before.
Right. So it adds a lot of complexity and richness of flavor for what is a relatively lightly aged rum.
So we've seen a few breweries in Michigan start to distill spirits. Why is that happening?
Well, a lot of the technology that you need to ferment beer can be converted over to fermenting spirits as well. And certainly the know-how and knowing how to manage alcohol, knowing how to manage the state's distribution system probably comes in really handy. So I think it's an obvious next step for people looking to expand their profile in the state and to appeal to people who don't necessarily drink beer.
Tell us about the Old Trousers. How do you make that?
So it's another one of these really easy cocktails. Clearly, I don't like to work very much for my drinking in the winter. So it is an ounce of the freshwater Michigan rum, and you could use any rum you like, but this one's a really nice choice. And then a half an ounce of Gosling's rum. So this is Gosling's Black Seal. This is not made in Michigan. This is a style of rum that we call a black blended rum. And so it's really dark in color, and it has some viscosity and richness to it. And it's kind of an irreplaceable flavor. Drinks that call for it, this is really, you know, what
There's
you're
no
looking
substitute.
For. There's no real substitute for. There are a variety of black blended rums, but they really do make a big difference in the cocktail. And then a half an ounce of honey syrup. And I just combined all those into a beer glass, a nice snifter style beer glass, with a dash of Angostura bitters. Stirred that up to make sure my honey syrup got dissolved. And then I topped that off with as much beer as I wanted. I did about 6 ounces. You could stretch that out to 8 ounces. And then the thing that really makes this cocktail is you just sprinkle some ground cinnamon on top, and it just gives it this really amazing aroma, perfect for a winter day.
Well, I'd like to try that. Let's see. Oh, well, cinnamon's really, when you take a sniff of it, it's really present. But you can pick up the porter as well. Let me try this. Sweet up front, kind of a bitter chocolate taste at the end. Really nice. In the meantime, you're picking up that honey, which I'm surprised that it comes out so clearly on that drink.
Right. So it should take a minute just to talk about honey in cocktails. So what I used here was a honey syrup. So if you were to just take your honey bear and squeeze it into a drink that's usually served cold, it doesn't dilute very well, doesn't mix very well. So a lot of cocktails will call for a honey syrup, and you make that just by mixing 2 or 3 parts honey with one part of hot water just to loosen it up and make it blend more easily into drinks.
Okay, that's the Old Trousers with Founders Porter and the Freshwater Barrel Rum from New Holland. Thanks very much.
Cheers.
Coming up,
Community Court views community service as a form of restitution.
Justice for and by the community in Southwest Detroit. That's in 20 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Election officials around the nation are concerned about hacking schemes that might corrupt the outcomes. But really, how likely is that? Joining me to talk about it is Riley Began. She's with Bridge Magazine and has written a report titled, As Hacking Fears Mount, Michigan Election Security Gets Middling Marks. So your work started with a report from the Center for American Progress, which graded states on election security. What grade did Michigan get?
So we got a C, which is a solid middle-of-the-road grade, but before you're too sad about it, it's pretty similar to most other states. There were a couple that got Bs. I don't think any got As, but then there were a decent amount that got Ds and Fs as well.
So we're all in trouble.
Yeah.
So it sounds like we got a mixed bag here. What's Michigan doing right?
We are replacing all of our voting machines before the elections this year. So we have brand new voting machines, which means that the software is pretty much as good as it can get. And I think the really key thing that we're doing right is that we have paper ballots as a part of our system. That means that if, for whatever reason, something goes wrong with the electronic side of our voting machines, we have this physical record of how people voted.
So our security risks are less about Russians hacking into the system and altering the results. It sounds like the risks are basically of our own making. So we audit some of those paper ballots, but not all of them. Is that good enough?
It depends on how you look at it. So in the past, actually, we haven't audited any of those ballots. We do these things called procedural audits, which means you go to the precinct and you just make sure that the people who work there are following all of the rules that they need to follow.
So it's not an actual audit of the results.
Yes, but going forward, the Secretary of State's office says they are going to do that. They don't seem to have any sort of statistical reasoning behind why or how many they choose certain precincts. So it's definitely better. What they're going to be doing is better than what they have done in the past. But there are some other ways that can be a little bit more thorough. That's a risk-limiting audit, which experts are recommending. One expert told me it was called the gold standard of audits. And that is something where you use the statistical method to make sure that you are auditing enough precincts. And that's something that they'd recommend for Michigan, but doesn't look like we would necessarily be adopting that anytime soon.
Well, recounts are one way to check accuracy, but you report Michigan's really strict about that, among the strictest in the nation. In what way?
Yeah, so we have this rule that make sure that precincts can't be involved in a recount if there are certain problems with the ballot. So it could be, you know, there was some tampering with the ballot boxes or the seal isn't put down correctly. You know, or if someone puts the ballot into the machine more than once, it could show there's a discrepancy between the amount of ballots put in and the amount of people who signed in to vote. So if any of those sorts of small things happen, it could basically eliminate a precinct from being qualified to be participating in a recount.
So if you're a really smart person who wants to corrupt an election, all you do is put a bunch of messed up ballots or in a box or something like that, it sounds like. If we need laws to clean this up, is anybody showing any interest in doing that?
Yeah, so there are two different things that are happening right now. There is a group of Detroit lawmakers who have introduced a bill that would essentially take that out of our legal code. But that has been sitting in committee, hasn't received a hearing yet. And then there's another group called Promote the Vote that's seeking signatures to present a ballot initiative in November that would also eliminate that.
Detroit was a trouble spot in 2016. In fact, a lot of the votes there couldn't be recounted. What's being done, if anything, to improve that situation?
Yeah, so now the city is implementing mandatory testing and reevaluation for poll workers before the midterm election to make sure that they still are aware of all the processes and hopefully the same mistakes won't happen again.
That is Riley Bagan. She wrote the article, As Hacking Fears Mount, Michigan Election Security Gets Middling Marks. She's with Bridge Magazine. Thanks for telling us about this.
Thank you.
That voters' rights group Riley mentioned called Promote the Vote is being backed by several groups, including the League of Women Voters. That group's president is Judy Karanjeff, and she joins us now. Hi there.
Hi.
Your proposal calls for several changes. Let's go down the list one by one. First, automatic registration when someone conducts business at the Secretary of State office. How does that differ from what Michigan does now?
You may remember that we were the first state that passed registration when you got your driver's license. This would make it automatic that you would be registered when you go in to get your driver's license or your state ID. Right now, usually after you've waited a while and then gone through the process of getting your driver's license or your ID, you're asked if you want to register to vote. And that takes additional time, and most people say no, thank you. They'll do it later. This would make it automatic.
You have to be registered at least 30 days before an election right now, but you want the election officials to offer a sort of day of registration. How would that work?
We would have two changes in this proposal. Right now, we're one of the most strict states saying that you can't register after 30 days. And this would change it first that you can register by mail or in person up to 15 days prior to the election. And then after that, 14 days up through Election Day, you can register in person. You can't register by mail, but you can register in person as long as you can show your state ID and your proof of residency.
Another part of this is giving members of the military more time to vote. Why is that needed?
There's been studies that show that military personnel do not feel their ballot's going to be returned in time. This would assure them that they're going to get mailed a ballot 45 days prior to the election and anyone else living overseas.
This would allow straight party voting and make it part of the state constitution. Why did you think that was necessary?
Michigan's had straight party ticket for over 100 years. Twice the legislature has removed that, and twice the people voted and restored it. So we think this is the will of the people in Michigan. It seems to be needed in Michigan because our ballot is extremely long and voting can be extremely time-consuming. 50% of the people in the last two presidential elections actually used straight party ticket. It's used in all of our counties. It's an option for people. It's not mandatory, but it's a choice they can make if they prefer to vote a straight party ticket.
Finally, absentee voting without the need to give a reason. Why do you think that's important?
37 states and the District of Columbia already allow no reason absentee. In Michigan, in the 2016 election, 22% of the votes cast were absentee. But in Texas, where they have no reason absentee, 50% of the people voted prior to Election Day. This would help people that at the last minute discover they can't be at the polls for some emergency. It also takes away the threat of committing a misdemeanor if you fill out the reason incorrectly, and it makes it easier and quicker to vote.
What kind of pushback are you seeing from opponents to these proposals?
Really, we haven't seen any yet.
Are you out on the street getting signatures yet?
Yes, we have volunteers around the state that are out getting signatures, and soon we'll have paid canvassers as well.
And you need more than 315,000 signatures, correct?
We're hoping to have 400,000 signatures turned in by the end of June.
Judy Karanjeff is the president of the League of Women Voters, one of the groups backing a proposed constitutional amendment to make registering and voting easier. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michigan Governor Rick Snyder is calling for a Marshall Plan for Talent. He wants the legislature to approve $100 million for programs, equipment, and scholarships to train the hundreds of thousands of workers that will be needed in the next several years. Joining me to talk about that are Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican Majority Leader in the State Senate. He joins us via Skype. And Buzz Thomas, a principal at Thomas Group Consulting and former Democratic Leader in both the House and the Senate. Welcome, Buzz.
Thank you very much, Lester. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I guess it's assumed everyone knows what the Marshall Plan was, but if you missed that day of class, it's named after former Secretary of State George Marshall. It was a very successful program that helped rebuild Europe after the devastation of World War II by pumping in billions of dollars in economic assistance. Now, having said that, Ken, what do you think of Governor Snyder's Marshall Plan for Talent?
I think he deserves a lot of credit. I think he's trying to position it as a new approach to workforce talent development, how best to educate young people for the jobs of the future. I do think it's mostly about technical and vocational training, trying to match schools with companies that need workers with certain credentials and skills and that sort of thing. Kind of comes on the heels of Amazon's rejection of Michigan as a place for their second headquarters because of a lack of talent. So my hat's off to them. I think there are some other issues that we probably want to talk about, like this third grade reading issue. But
we'll get to that.
I think he deserves credit for putting this on the table and trying to rethink workforce talent development.
Buzz, I was looking at that $100 million number. Is that enough to train a workforce for the future?
Well, I don't believe that it is a Marshall Plan as we think historically a Marshall Plan, which rebuilt all of Europe. But I think it is a very important piece of a bigger dialogue that needs to happen as we rethink how our entire education system in Michigan gets us to being the top 10 state that we aspire to be. You know, having this talent discussion around vocational education and around technical education, around qualifying individuals to find the tech jobs, the computer jobs, the IT jobs that are readily available now and that are very difficult to fill, I think that's critically important. But I think it's just part of a much broader discussion.
Let's talk about education a little bit. I mean, Michigan has cut funding to public universities, and compared to where it once was, you know, K through 12 schools used to be among the top 10 in the nation. Now we're middling in the pack there. The governor now, as Ken mentioned, wants businesses to outline what they need and educators to design programs to meet that need. Ken, what do you think of that approach?
Well, nothing's going to work if our young people aren't educated. And if they can't read, they're not going to be able to go into this pipeline for talent development. And so, if anything, you know, we need another Marshall Plan, I guess, for K-12 education in terms of achievement, because recent data indicates that, at least if you look at third grade reading levels, Michigan's actually declining in achievement, not progressing. And a Marshall Plan for talent's not going to work if kids aren't educated.
What do you think of the idea of businesses and educators getting together and say, here, let's map out a plan? Is that a good idea or not?
Well, it's not a bad idea. So, yeah, I think it is a good idea. My point is, part of the plan has to be, how do we improve, for example, third grade reading levels? We can't have businesses and educators get together just to talk about the kinds of jobs these businesses need without looking at some of the foundational aspects of talent. And I would suggest that reading is one of them.
Buzz, should businesses be actively helping schools implement the training for the workforce they need?
Absolutely. If I could, you know, wave my magic wand, businesses would be available to participate in that. Kids would be in school much longer. Kind of cooperative education that weaves education with real-life work experience so that kids are really aware of what they're getting into, that would all be a part of the solution. I tip my cap to anyone that wants to engage employers and employers that want to be engaged in creating a better workforce. I think that just creates a happier, more incentivized community.
Buzz, do you think educators will be receptive to that?
I think educators will be receptive to the notion that this is a part of the solution. This is not one size that fits all, and this is not going to fix everything. There will be some that will still criticize that we're slotting people or tracking people into just going into a job versus going into higher education. And there's certainly statistics that show that those with 4-year degrees and higher will earn more in their lifetime. There's going to be something for everyone to like, and there's going to be something for everyone to criticize. I think as long as we continue to stay focused that this is just one part of many different questions that we need to answer and one part of a multi-dimensional solution, then it's a good thing.
Ken, those third grade reading scores you were talking about, Ron French at Bridge Magazine reported that Michigan spent $80 million more to improve reading, and then reading scores for third graders went down. What's going wrong?
First of all, these results, the decline in third grade reading proficiency in Michigan, are just terrible and pathetic. And what's most astounding to me is that the relative indifference to this on the part of policymakers. Now, in terms of your question, $80 million spread among 500 plus school districts is not a lot of money. So it's too thinly spread and it's not targeted well. Districts or kids that need the most help aren't getting the most help. And the strategies being used, apparently, in some districts just aren't working. But bottom line, this is a pathetic situation bordering on sort of crisis. I mean, how do you do a Marshall Plan for talent if we're declining in third grade reading scores?
Buzz, this $80 million that was spent, you know, this bolsters the arguments made by conservatives that throwing more money at schools does not guarantee better educated kids. What's missing in this mix?
Ken hit the nail on the head. I hope that folks recognize this as a crisis. Typically, conservatives would tell you that everything that's wrong within public education happens in distressed urban districts where you have high concentrations of poverty. The study that just came out and the results that came out show that it's across the board. All kids in Michigan are underperforming and underachieving. And so I would hope that folks would really kind of buckle down. I think there are a number of things that need to happen. I mean, I think it underscores that you have just a great deal of kids that are starting first grade ill-equipped to learn, and early childhood education should be greater emphasized so that kids are starting, you know, K-12 in a position ready to learn. That's critically important. I think finding ways for lawmakers to stop arguing about curriculum and Common Core and creating some stability within school districts so that curriculums can align with the testing and the place that kids need to be is also going to be very important. Perhaps we should revisit the debate in terms of how many cooks are in the kitchen, so to speak, when it comes to the stability of the school system. You've got the legislature, you've got a state board of education, you've got a department of education, you've got intermediate school districts, all with seemingly competing agendas at time that I think create great uncertainty for educators. And ultimately, I think a stable education with really good educators getting back to the basics can get Michigan to where it needs to be. In Michigan, we're the birthplace of the public university. It's not like we don't know how to do this. We just seem to have lost our way and gotten caught up in lots of other little fights. And I think if we stay focused, we can get back to where we need to be.
That is Buzz Thomas. He's a former Democratic legislative leader. We also heard from Ken Sekema, a former Republican legislative leader. Thanks to both of you. Hey, and have a great weekend.
Thanks, Lester.
Thank you.
Still to come, some faculty and staff at the University of Michigan have raised concerns about a concierge medicine service that gives wealthier patients special treatment. We'll be right back after a short break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. If you commit a misdemeanor in Michigan, the likely sentence is a fine and or jail time. But each Wednesday in the 36th District Court in Detroit, a different form of punishment gets handed out. That's because the Southwest Detroit Community Justice Center offers what's called a community court program. Tanya Phillips is the center's executive director, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And also here is Triana Rhodes. She recently went through the community court program and is here to share her experience. Welcome.
Thank you.
So let's start with a basic definition. What is a community court? How does it differ?
A community court really involves the judicial system and the community working together to solve complex issues. What community court does is provide an opportunity if you receive a ticket for a misdemeanor offense in the community. Like you mentioned earlier, instead of your traditional penalties of jail or high fines that a lot of folks can't afford, we're looking at a third option, and that's to give back to the community. Community court views community service as a form of restitution, acknowledging that, okay, everything wasn't perfect, but this is how we're going to remedy. This is how we're going to make things right, by giving back. We also have a case manager, and that's where we work one-on-one, and we just partner with everybody in our program. We're there to help with things like job placement, continuing your education, healthcare counseling, and after people have gone through the program successfully, like Triana, we're there afterwards. So you have that long-lasting partnership, and this model has been shown when you look at the person, as a human being, not just a number, not just a statistic, not just an incident, then crime actually goes down, safety increases, and the overall quality of our life in our communities improve. In a nutshell, that's community court. It's about
community.
So I want
to talk about where it came from, but let me ask Triana, because I'm curious. You've gone through the program. Why did you opt to participate in it?
Well, because it helped me, you know, be able to accomplish different other things other than just the community service. I was able to get help with, you know, paying off my tickets or, you know, different things I needed for my babies or any other thing, you know, gas, anything I needed extra, household items, furniture. So that's why I was, you know.
Can I ask what your community service was?
I was at a hockey rink, and I helped the kids skate and clean up and serve the hot chocolate.
How was that experience?
Yeah, it was great. It was great because I got to meet a different culture of people and, you know, try to learn Spanish and everything like that. Yep.
Tanya, how typical is an experience like that?
It's very typical. I mean, we are amazed. I continue to be amazed at how rich this experience is. And that's part of the model, that you're, again, not being isolated. You're being integrated into the community in a positive way. Triana, speaking of Clark Park, which is one of the gems of Southwest Detroit, a nonprofit park facility. So we work together, we partner and get things done. And oftentimes, even when the program has ended, people continue to volunteer to stay engaged, and those partnerships and relationships and that support system last a lifetime.
When and where did this idea of a community court come about? Is this unique to Detroit, or do we see this other places?
Both. It's a national model, and it's currently unique to Detroit. So we're the first community court program in Detroit. But community courts are all across the nation, even all across the world. The first community courts began in New York with the Midtown Community Court and Red Hook Community Justice Center, and they've been spreading everywhere since.
How do you measure the court's success?
We measure quantitative and qualitative success. We do look at completion rates as a measure of success, and we average 90% completion rates in terms of complying with the court's orders, which is a big deal. So you not only have a stick, we have a carrot approach. So you're not only doing your community service and getting help from the community and from us as an agency, at the end of the day, most tickets are dismissed too. So you're walking away with a second chance and a clean slate. And that's important to the larger scheme of issues in society. You don't want to have anyone, you don't want to have Triana or any of our participants carry the burden of a criminal record with them along the way if that's not necessary.
So Triana sounds like a model example.
Absolutely.
I want to talk about the challenges just for a second. I'm sure not everybody is suited for this. Have you had problems, or can you tell me about the challenges?
Well, you know, we've been very, very fortunate. We haven't had a lot of challenges, but there are some classes of cases that we cannot take by law. So, for example, drunk driving can be a misdemeanor offense, or it can be a felony offense. But as a misdemeanor, there are different statutory requirements and triggers for that offense, so they would not be able to participate in community court. And as I said, we haven't had too many challenges. We've been very fortunate. I would say maybe the most typical challenge, if you call it that, is just being able to work with people's work schedules, you know, particularly with seasonal work. And how we've adjusted to that is that we do community service almost 7 days a week, pretty much. So we try our best to have slots available for everyone. We have your traditional Monday through Friday, but we recognize some people work afternoons, some people work evenings. You know, there's childcare issues. So we also have things available on Saturdays, on Sundays, and afternoons and evenings. We do our best to create an environment of success. And when you create an environment where people can succeed, where you make it easy, where the system is not trying to push against you, then people do succeed.
Triana, Tanya's been talking about this idea of isolation because, you know, you're just another docket number and just another thing to get through the regular court versus this idea of you being engaged with the community. And I'm wondering, do you feel more connected with the community because of this service that you've done?
Yes, I feel very comfortable going to different, you know, events like that. Now I'm more, you know, engaged in it because I experienced, you know, firsthand how it goes and what we're able to do and different things that's given to us when we do complete whatever it is that we need to.
I only have one more question. Where's the future of this? Will we see this in more cities, or are we seeing it in more cities in Michigan?
Well, I think the future is bright for community court. We want to expand our model more in the city of Detroit. I believe there are some efforts going on in Kalamazoo. I know there's a street outreach court here in Ann Arbor. So the restorative justice model or other, sometimes it's also referenced as a problem-solving model. I think that's the wave of the future in terms of how cases are going to be handled.
We've been talking to Tanya Phillips with the Southwest Detroit Community Justice Center and Triana Rhodes. We've been talking about the community court program that Tanya heads up and Triana just went through. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The University of Michigan is reaching out to donors, offering better access to its hospital's doctors for an annual fee. For $2,700 a year, a patient can take advantage of what's known as a concierge medicine service the hospital is calling Victor's Care. According to its website, patients pay an annual membership fee in exchange for enhanced access and time with their primary care physician. Concierge medicine is a fairly common practice in hospitals in certain areas of the country. Many private practice doctors have also offered the service because it means more money and they can concentrate on fewer patients. Also, it means care is not as restricted by health insurance company guidelines. But there are some concerns about a service that gives wealthier patients special treatment, especially at a public university hospital. Joining me now is Susan Gould. She is a professor at the Medical School and the School of Public Health. She's also a faculty member for the Center for Bioethics and Social Sciences in Medicine. First, so we better understand the Victor's Care service, what all do you get for that annual fee?
Well, my understanding is, and remember, it hasn't rolled out yet, that folks who enroll in Victor's Care will have 24/7 access to their primary care physician. They will also have assistance sort of navigating appointments. They'll be seen at a different office with apparently free parking, and at the University of Michigan Medical Center, that's a big deal. And also access to a variety of tests listed on the Victor's Care website.
How do you accomplish all of that with existing staff?
Well, my understanding of this, and Dr. Runge, our dean, confirmed this at a sort of town hall style panel discussion a couple of weeks ago, is that this will be a fairly small number of patients. I believe he said up to 600 is the plan. And so, you know, the need for additional space and or personnel is relatively small. They're going to be seen at a different location. I believe it's on Old Earhart Road. Have so far as I know, one primary care physician has plans to be involved in Victor's Care.
That meeting you talked about, the ethics committee meeting, I understand it was a packed house there as the medical providers at the U of M had a few concerns and questions. What are the biggest concerns?
Yeah, and I have to say, by the way, that I'm extremely proud of our medical staff for raising concerns about issues related to equity and fairness in access to care. So that was one of the concerns, was will this affect access to care for other patients? And, you know, is that something that they plan to examine? Will they be making sure that that doesn't happen, that there is a worse access to care for people who aren't members of Victor's Care? So that's one issue. Another issue would be not just access to primary care, but whether folks enrolled in Victor's Care will have help, what they say in England, jumping the queue.
Right.
Okay. When it comes to getting in.
Exactly. Would this be a golden ticket to get to the front of the line when other people are waiting for referrals to specialists?
Dr. Runge said that that would not be the case. Again, I think, you know, we need to see what happens. But that was a concern also articulated by physicians here.
If you're a Victor's Care patient, and let's say you have a number of health complaints, real or imagined, how much time do you get with your primary care physician? How many tests and scans can you request with your golden ticket?
I think actually the main issue is the access that you have to your primary care physician, which is 24/7, you know, cell phone, text, whatever, and also more face-to-face time with your primary care physician, which, as a primary care physician myself, I think is a real benefit to patients to be able to have more time to articulate concerns and talk about your needs. In terms of testing, things like what is called the executive physical, stuff like stress tests and vitamin levels and all kinds of different blood tests and stuff like that, I'm not sure that that is something that will be available, quote unquote, on demand. That was raised with Dr. Runge as an issue of concern, particularly for an institution like University of Michigan, which really has been at the forefront in terms of our health policy work and health policy research on promoting high-value care and trying to help find ways to limit providing low or especially no-value care. So that was another concern articulated. And again, we'll see what happens. It's really hard to make any judgments about a program that hasn't started yet.
As I read about these kinds of concierge services, it was again and again stressed, this is a way to raise revenue. Is the U of M hospital in some sort of great need of more revenue?
You know, there's an old saying in not-for-profit healthcare, no margin, no mission. We still have a positive margin. Like many healthcare organizations, we're constantly trying to improve that and to make sure that we can pay our staff and take care of patients who can't pay and stuff like that. I'm not sure Victor's Care is being proposed as a way of contributing to sort of revenue versus expense bottom line. My understanding is that it's being proposed as a way of getting friendly donors to donate more money. And, you know, the University of Michigan, Michigan Medicine, and the University of Michigan in general relies quite a bit on donations to accomplish its missions.
Let me bottom line this. Do you think that it's appropriate for a public university hospital to offer a concierge service?
Well, I will say that depends on the concierge service. What are its goals? Are those goals consistent with the mission of the public institution? And will the actions and the outcomes of that program help to meet that mission? Concierge medicine is not inherently unethical, okay? However, as I think our physicians brought up quite appropriately, physicians are expected, in fact, obligated really, to consider the impact of their work on access to care. They're expected to make sure that people don't go without health care for reasons of financial obstacles. You know, now, there are degrees of that, obviously. But like I said, concierge medicine, it's also sometimes called direct primary care or retainer care, comes in lots of different models, lots of different ways, and it doesn't have to necessarily impair access for people who can't afford to pay the fee. In fact, some concierge doctors make sure that a certain percentage of their patients are not paying, would not be able to afford to pay. There are practices in concierge medicine that do, you know, pro bono work and that sort of thing. So I think there are different ways of getting a concierge model to meet the mission of a healthcare organization, especially a not-for-profit public healthcare organization.
So it's all in how you execute it.
It is. And like I said, it hasn't really started yet. So a lot of it is, for instance, the number of patients involved. What impact does that have on access to care for others? So we know there are wait times for primary care appointments, for specialty appointments, for MRIs or CAT scans or whatever. If this is about, 200, 300, 600 people, probably the impact on access for others would be minimal. If it's thousands of people, the impact on access to care for others would be most likely larger, okay? So, but I also have to say that there's a fairness issue and the issue of jumping the queue that I brought up earlier. So for instance, I'm a primary care doc, and if I have a patient who needs to be seen, and this happens periodically, sooner than the standard wait time to see a specialist, I call them and I say, for medical need reasons, this person needs to be seen sooner than your next available appointment. And almost inevitably, they squeeze them in somehow. I wouldn't want that to happen for people just because they're members of Victor's Care, okay? That should really be about medical need, not financial wherewithal.
Dr. Susan Gould is a professor at the Medical School and the School of Public Health. She's also a faculty member for the Center for Bioethics and Social Sciences in Medicine at the U of M. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me and for your interest in this.
We requested an interview with Dean Marshall Runge. His office declined our request, but they did offer this statement. It says in part, Victor's Care is a pilot program developed after requests from patients for a service similar to what exists at institutions across the country. This is just one of a number of ways we're seeking to improve access to and efficiency of care we provide. And then it goes on to say, we're committed to ethical, accessible care for all of our patients, and whatever programs we put in place should not diminish that in any way. This will not adversely affect the success of other patients to our outstanding healthcare system. And finally, some faculty and staff have raised concerns. We've listened to them, and we are working together to come up with solutions that are mutually satisfactory for the benefit of our patients. That's the end of that statement. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Joy Horan, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Don't forget the time chain this weekend. Spring forward 1 hour. Also, it's a good idea to change your smoke alarm batteries. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.